Lowe's knows laundry day should be easy. Achieve maximum versatility with a dryer door that swings open either way, making load transfer from washer to dryer a breeze. Plus, with LG ThinQ, save time by controlling your washer remotely. Shop LG, America's most reliable line of home appliances, today at Lowe's. Based on independent reliability surveys 2021 to 2024 and select major appliances as compared to competing manufacturers offering full appliance lines. See associate for more details. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, exclusions apply. Valid 6/18 through 7/9.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. The case that I'm going to cover today is one that you asked me to do, and it was mind-blowing, I'm not going to lie. So, buckle up, get your seatbelts on. This really is going to be a ride. Starts on the 8th of January, 2007. It's around 3:30 p.m. 13-year-old William, known as Ben Ownby, steps off the school bus in Beaufort, Missouri. He'd done that 100 times before, hundreds of times before. You know, he'd followed that route home constantly. And he was actually a self-confessed computer nerd. So his big dream was he was going to go to college and he was going to study computer programming. So very much part of the modern age, a young person with big ideas. And he begins walking towards his home. His friends with him, 15-year-old Mitchell Hultz of Franklin County. Mitchell left Ben and goes to get in his car. His car was parked on a hill nearby, and actually he always parked his car in the vicinity of the bus stop because he took the bus to school and then obviously used the car when he got off the bus to go home. This meant that Ben was left a relatively short distance to walk home alone, just as he'd done hundreds and hundreds of times before. The only thing is, this time he didn't make it home. Ben never arrived home. Now, when you have a child, you expect certain habits from that child, and when they fall foul of those habits, you immediately get concerned. If somebody's behaviour isn't consistent with their daily routine, then the minute that that routine is broken, it causes you to question where they are, and that's exactly what happened for Ben's father. Usually, he meets his son at home by 3:45 p.m. every single day. When Ben failed to return home by 4:10 p.m., he literally knew something was very wrong. It was an immediate reaction. So a lot of us parents know that our children do things like go and hang out with their mates without telling us, leaving us to feel horrified and believing something catastrophic has happened. Believe me, my youngest son drives a moped. My eldest son drives a car. Whenever they're out, the minute the phone goes, I'm like, something terrible has befallen my child. It shouldn't, but it does. That's what parents are like. But they also have really clear habits. So if they're not coming home at night because they're staying with a friend, for example, they're going to let me know. If they didn't let me know, it wouldn't matter, and even if they've forgotten, it wouldn't matter. It would be me on the phone constantly ringing around hospitals or the police because I would be so terrified that something had occurred. And it's exactly the same for Ben's dad. He instinctively, intuitively knows something is wrong and his son has probably come to some level of harm. So frantically, both his parents begin calling all his friends and family, and they quickly establish that Ben's with nobody. So nobody that they know has got sight or sound of him. And it's at that point, straight away, and this is really early on in him disappearing, they contact the police. It is completely out of character. He always goes straight home after school. He's a really responsible child. Listen, Ben was a Boy Scout with a straight A record at school. Emotionally, he was in a good place. He'd never run away from home. He had absolutely no reason to do that. And also, when the police asked his parents about the kind of child that he was, they made it clear this is not a kid who would stop and talk to strangers. He always arrived home from school and then either read or played on his computer. This habit was completely ingrained and entrenched. For him to break that meant something pretty serious had happened. At this point, the police do take it very seriously, and that's really important because I think we can all be reminded of certain cases where the police don't necessarily believe that the child is in danger and they say that they've maybe just gone and hung out somewhere they shouldn't, they've run away, and it can lead to catastrophic impacts and the child ending up dead when they'd actually been kidnapped or harmed. And actually, if they had responded quicker and not just seen it as a runaway, there would have been hopefully a different result. It's not the case as far as Ben's concerned. They take it really seriously straight away. And an endangered persons alert was issued on the same day of Ben's appearance. Now, this is one step below an Amber Alert. So in America, they have a really effective system when children disappear. And Ben's goes at one step below this Amber Alert. And the reason for this is because the authorities are not quite sure at this point if he had been abducted. They then start a full-scale search. They use bloodhounds in the woods, in the area around Ben's home, and friends and families, members, they all get involved in the search. So this is going full-scale. They're taking it incredibly seriously. However, as police start to speak to witnesses who were in the area around the time that Ben disappeared, they start getting really concerned, particularly when they speak to his friend Mitchell. That's the person who's last seen him, of course. Now, he initially tells police that he left Ben, and at this point, after leaving Ben, he stopped at a friend's house for 2 to 3 minutes. This wasn't true, actually, and I completely have sympathy and empathy for Mitchell. Let's just put ourselves in perspective of a 15-year-old child, right? When you've done something that you know is a bit naughty or wrong, and you're dealing with police officers, enforcers of the law, you may stretch the truth a little bit. You know, let's say you've been having a spliff and then you get interviewed by them later on. You're not going to be like, oh, I was just skinning up and smoking some weed, officer. You'll be like, I was just reading a book by myself in a quiet area under a tree with no witnesses. That kind of thing. Totally and utterly forgivable. So even though Mitchell tells this story about being at a friend's for a few minutes, it stopped her, he then actually goes back and explains that he'd left Ben because he wanted to go and collect his car, and that car had been parked on the hill. The reason he'd lied was because he was too young to drive, so he didn't actually have an official license and he didn't want to get into trouble, which, like I said, we understand. Then he claims, in spite of this, he was an incredible witness. Literally, we all want a Mitchell in our lives. Let me just tell you what this kid remembered. So he claimed that he'd last seen Ben running down the hill towards home. Now, as he'd set off driving in that car, illegally driving in that car, Mitchell nonetheless, but pat on the head for what I'm going to talk about next, he sees this dilapidated white Nissan pickup truck. It backs up to a ditch and then it drives past him in the opposite direction and it speeds up a gravel road from where Ben had been walking. Now, at that point, of course, Mitchell hadn't thought anything of it. But then, of course, he finds out there's no longer any sign of his friend. So it's only when he realizes that Ben has been missing for a short period of time that it starts to alert him to the possibility that that particular truck may have had something to do with his disappearance. Now, Mitchell was, by the grace of God, a truck enthusiast. So he is able to give police a lot of information about the vehicle that he'd seen speeding away at the time of Ben's disappearance. And I mean, a lot of information. Bear in mind, I struggle to remember pretty much anything on a day-to-day level. I will walk out of the door, somebody could nearly knock me down, I wouldn't know what car it was. My brain doesn't do that information. It's as simple as that. But if you do want to know what happened to me in 1989 at a kid's party and so on and so forth, I'm great at those kind of details, bizarrely. I'm just not very good at that day-to-day detail that certain people are. Mitchell is incredible. He describes it as a white Nissan pickup truck with a camper shell, that it had no hubcaps and a rusty left rear fender. I kid you not, guys, this kid, savant of car details, savant of trucks, this kid remembered all of this. So it had no hubcaps and rusty rear fender, as I've said, badly dented on the rear passenger side. And The description was literally so detailed, the police actually initially thought he might be making it up. Because obviously this is not what we expect to have from a 15-year-old young person, that they can intricately detail this particular truck. But because he had this connection with them, it was something that his brain simply connected with. But the police, in spite of thinking that he might have made it up, then go,
what is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Speak to residents in the area, and what happens? Yeah, it's confirmed. A lot of people had seen the same truck earlier in the day, and they'd seen it driving around the area. This area was a very close-knit community, and because of that, people tended to notice unfamiliar things like a foreign truck to some degree in that location. So it's really helpful because now they're piecing together the fact that even though it seems to be an outsider's truck, it's been noted by several sources, and they do have a pretty good description. Well done, Mitchell, simple as that. So based on this information that they've obtained, the police do now think, wow, we may be looking at a child abduction. Ben may have been kidnapped. As the case involved a child, the Highway Patrol and the National Centre for Missing and Exploited Children joined in the search. That's alongside, as I've said, dozens of volunteers and family members and so on. The FBI, well, they also open up an investigation and they start working directly with the Franklin County Sheriff's Department in search for Ben. They are desperate to bring this boy home and more concerned about the possibility that they are looking at a child who has been kidnapped, which is terrifying because a lot of us know when a child is kidnapped, there's going to be a really poor outcome unless something pretty incredible happens. So they set up a roadblock in the area, and this means that officers start stopping drivers and they start checking in the car boots to make sure that if the child is still present in that locality, they can stop them being removed. Now, when a child goes missing, time is absolutely of the essence. Most are found within 72 hours. Furthermore, chances of a successful recovery increase greatly when images of the child are released to the public as soon as possible. So this includes activating the Amber Alert system. Now, the Amber Alert system, for those of you who don't know, is named after 9-year-old Amber Hagerman. She was sadly abducted and she was murdered in Arlington, Texas. That was in 1996. She was forcibly dragged into a black pickup truck and her body was later found in a creek. Her throat had been cut and her killer never been brought to justice. And when you think about killers who do that, they are likely carrying on killing. So whether they have been found guilty for other crimes and are safely locked away or whether they are still out there, who knows? That Amber system is incredible. 579 children's lives have been saved since the Amber Alert system was introduced in 1986. That's incredible. They took it so seriously that they ensured that all those children who I've just talked about number-wise have managed to be brought home safely. On the second day of Ben's disappearance, this is when the Amber Alert was issued for him. And it included the following details. It said, Ben is 4'10" tall. He weighs around 100 pounds. He was last seen wearing a red St. Louis Rams sweatshirt with a hood, blue jeans, and carrying his black backpack. Ben has brown hair, blue eyes, and wears glasses. He is 13 years old and Caucasian. So that goes out. And at 4 p.m. that day, well, news conference gets held in Franklin County Sheriff's Department, and an FBI agent had a message for the kidnapper. And this was the message. We are coming after you, and we intend to recover that child. Don't know why I did it in that kind of enforced accent of kind of superiority and authority, but I think it's important to do so. And I imagine that that was how they put it across as well. We are gonna get you. You better be ready. And it kind of makes me feel really protected when I think about individuals like that working to bring home these children. It's incredible. The search continues, of course. They are leaving no stone unturned. But with no other leads, the local police are basically advised to keep an eye out for the vehicle that matches the description provided by Ben's amazing friend, Mitchell. However, a lot of people are very afraid at this point that Ben may be added to the list of America's disappeared children. It's mind-blowing when I tell you these statistics. Approximately every 40 seconds, a child goes missing or is abducted in the US. This equates to around 800,000 children reported missing each year. In the UK, the figure is around 110,000. Globally, the figure is a staggering 1 million. 1 million. Now, thankfully, as I said a little bit before, the vast majority, around 99% of these, well, they're found within hours. Or even if they're not found in hours, they are ultimately found alive. Many are runaways, lost or injured, some of them. And a large proportion are taken by a family member, often in a custody battle, for example. A significant number are actually targeted by acquaintances, and these tend to be people who are paedophiles, so they're abducted for sex offences. And of those who were abducted, the likelihood of finding them has actually risen sharply, dramatically in fact, due to technological advances. The benefits of social media alone in such cases are literally invaluable, because the news of an abduction can instantly be shared with millions, actually billions, of people nowadays. In 1990, the recovery rate in such cases was less than 2/3. So in 1990, the recovery rate of those children that had been abducted in those ways was less than 2/3, which is terrifying, right? Nowadays, it's around 97%. Incredible, right? However, as I've said, in spite of the fact that this is the case, and we do very well now in recovering children, when you think about the global context, many are literally never seen again. Now, of the multitude of children that go missing, it's estimated that 115 are abducted by strangers. It's a tiny proportion, but still, that's 115 too many. On average, over half, so 57% of these are found alive, but 40% are killed. So going on half, never get to go home. Typically, strangers will abduct a child in the commission of a sex offence. They will frequently identify a target. They'll learn their habits. They'll learn their movements. This basically increases the likelihood of a successful abduction. So you can imagine that Ben's parents at this point must have been desperately hoping that their son would not become one of these statistics. However, as the hours move on, and the days slowly trickled by, they must have begun to fear the worst. Any parent would be thinking, my God, the chances are my child is dead. And certainly, if I think of not having contact with my child for 24 hours and knowing that they weren't coming home or they couldn't come home, I would also believe that they were dead without a doubt. Now, during this investigation, the investigators also made contact with authorities in Lincoln County because they feared that Ben's disappearance could be connected to the disappearance of an 11-year-old boy 4 years previously. So 11-year-old Sean Hornbeck was actually abducted from an isolated rural road near his home in Washington County, Missouri. He had last been seen riding his bicycle to a friend's house on the 6th of October 2002. His family still held a vigil for him every single year. They were just desperate to keep his disappearance in the public eye. And it's really important. Think about Madeleine McCann's. And I know people are divided on Madeleine McCann and what happened. But let me tell you, always she is kept in the public eye by her parents. And it's important because it's unbelievable that people can go years without really thinking about the past. And then something triggers a memory. And you might have seen something 100 times, pictures of a child and so on and so forth, information about the disappearance, but then something triggers a memory. And it's those reasons why people keep these children in the public eye, because one memory can change everything. And for parents who've lost a child this way, closure is so important. You know, it's hard for people to get their heads around why people need a body in these cases. But if you're a parent and it's your child, my God, you need that body. You need to know. Yes, it's terrible, it's traumatizing, it's devastating, but my God, you need to know. And then you need to be able to lay them to rest. You need to be able to bring them home. And it's a powerful, powerful experience for parents who, even when they are bringing back the remains of their child, feel a sense of closure, at least that they know where their baby is. So these parents keep this child who's gone missing constantly in the public eye. And of course, the vast majority of people accepted the reality that he'd been abducted and murdered by a sexual predator. So the annual vigil for Sean actually became more of a memorial. And it was to help cope with Sean's disappearance. They also, as a family, invested so much of their energy into helping other people like themselves. So they themselves were trying to create opportunities to bring children home constantly. And they created the Sean Hornbeck Foundation to help search for missing children. Again, these parents who go through these horrific traumas, and all they think about is how to prevent other parents going through the same. It is something that I find immeasurably heartening, that these human beings who go through such tremendous loss devote themselves to other human beings. They want to take that child's disappearance and loss and make it into something legacy orientated so that they can protect other people. And it's testament to the kind of human beings that they are. And Sean Hornbeck's parents absolutely reflected this. Heroes, in my opinion. The reason that investigators were kind of compelled about these cases and thinking that they might be similar is they note the similarities between them. So both of the missing children were male. Both boys were a similar height. They were a similar weight. Both of them had brown hair. They were a similar age. They both actually had the appearance of pre-adolescence, so they looked younger. And both had been seen wearing blue jeans and a sports motif type top. Ben had been seen around 3:30 p.m. And Sean, when he was last seen all those years before, was seen at 4:30 p.m. Ben had vanished on a Monday and Sean was last seen on a Sunday. So these similarities kind of took the investigators down that rabbit hole, so to speak, to think, was this actually an individual who had also abducted prior to Ben's disappearance? Now, if the two cases were linked, let's be honest, at this point, it didn't bode well, because the other boy hadn't returned. So when thinking about whether Ben was going to come home, well, the likelihood is the information is telling us a different story, and the likelihood is he won't be coming home. Sean had literally vanished without a trace, and there had been no new leads in the 4 years since his disappearance, which must have been beyond haunting for his parents. 3 days after Ben's disappearance, his parents make this really emotional plea to his kidnapper. They want him to be brought home safe. And his father had said, Ben had his whole life ahead of him. They just wanted him home. It's as simple as that. They wanted to know that their son was going to get to have that future that he'd always wanted. He wanted to be that tech geek. He knew where he was going. And his mother and father wanted him to have that opportunity. Meanwhile, the authorities have to start stressing that Ben's friend, Mitchell, was not being treated as a suspect in his disappearance, because obviously, remember, this kid's kind of lied, also been very adept at giving intricate details about the truck. The police have been like, aren't we dealing with a potential murderer who's just lying his way out of this situation? And it became clear very quickly that wasn't the case. But Mitchell even had to take a lie detector test, and obviously he passed. But
what is dadication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariano. We call him Day Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dadication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Imagine being 15 and being told, take a lie detector test, and you're like, what if I fail? Well, everyone will think you're guilty of a really horrible crime and will probably just blame you. Because I think I'm one of those people that would just be found guilty straight away. I would fail a lie detector test just because I'd be like, I don't think I'm a liar, but maybe I am a liar. I don't know whether I'm a liar. I do that in my head. So I'm not sure that I'd be the kind of person to take a lie detector test. Equally, if you don't take it, you're going to look guilty. Fortunately, Mitchell, as I said, passes, and then they can reassure the local people in the area that this has got nothing to do with this poor 15-year-old kid whose only guilty situation was that he drove a car without a license. Now, later that same day, the 11th of January in 2007, whilst this intensive search for Ben is underway, two Kirkwood police officers, this is Gary Wagster and Chris Nelson, they respond to a call. It's a completely unrelated issue. They had to serve an arrest warrant. Their target lived in an apartment complex in the 400th block of South Holmes, Kirkwood. As they're leaving, after serving this arrest warrant, they notice a vehicle that's parked outside, and it just catches their attention. And Wagster asks his colleague, are you seeing what I'm seeing? It was a battered, old, white pickup truck. Oh, I've got goose pimples saying that. Yep, battered old white pickup truck. All officers were on the lookout at that point, remember, for this vehicle matching the description provided by Ben's savant truck noter friend, Mitchell. It matched the description perfectly, even down to the dents and rust. And at that moment, another resident in the complex approaches them, and he actually says, you might want to take a look at the truck, because he had been following the news of Ben's abduction, and he also thought it might be involved. He also has the information about who it belongs to. He says it belongs to a resident on the first floor who lived there with his son. So the officers took pictures of the vehicle, contact the Franklin County Sheriff, and they were advised at that moment that the truck did indeed match the description provided by Mitchell. Soon they also identify the address and the name of the owner. And the individual in question was 41-year-old pizza shop manager Michael John Devlin. Ah, he was a big guy, a burly 6'4", 21-stone man with wire-rimmed glasses and a beard. He was a loner who also worked part-time at a funeral home. What is it about a lot of people who work at funeral homes who, you know, you just shouldn't really have that person working for you at all? Maybe I'm just thinking about other cases I have covered, like David Fuller, when they're getting access to dead bodies and so on and so forth. I know, guys, people who work in funeral homes tend to be deeply empathic, lovely, compassionate humans. I'm just saying, these weirdos wheedle themselves in sometimes, don't they? Now, whilst officers are at the apartment complex, Devlin appeared to be taking the trash out. At this point, they actually recognise him from the pizza parlour he works at. And that pizza parlour is literally around the corner from the police station. They then question Devlin. Obviously, that's their duty. But he literally refuses to let them search his apartment. So the police at this point are absolutely convinced that they have a prime suspect. And come on, time is of the essence massively. So they're closely monitoring Devlin and they confront him at work the following morning. He's taken in actually for questioning the following morning by FBI agents. During the interrogation, Devlin soon makes a startling admission. He had abducted Ben. And not only had he abducted Ben, Ben was in his apartment. The investigators, obviously, on one level, this is music to their ears. They've got somebody admitting that the child who's been abducted is in their apartment. They quickly get search warrants and they raid the property. It was utterly filthy inside. And I mean, disgusting. The floor was covered with rubbish, cat hair, even had cat feces all over the floor. However, as they ventured further in, they couldn't believe their eyes. The missing boy was literally sat on a couch. When the officers entered, Ben looked up at them and said, "Are you going to take me home? Ugh, are you going to take me home?" The authorities and Ben's family could not have hoped for a better outcome. This is after four absolutely anxiety-filled days, and they haven't just recovered Ben, they have recovered him safe and well. And Ben was soon reunited with his relieved parents, William, who was known as Don Ownby, and Doris Ownby. His mother told the reporters, "We are just ecstatic. Don't want to let him go out of our sight." Apparently, one of the first things he did when he got home was just to start playing on his computer. And I think that we can all have that acknowledgement that whilst he obviously went through a highly traumatizing event, and we will all be aware of what will have gone on in that event and what will have happened to him during those 4 days, the point is getting home and the psychological connection, not only with your familiar people, your parents, you know, that sense of safety, but just seeing the things that had always connected you to your childhood, you know, the computer that he loved, and being able to just zone out of the trauma, because he would be traumatized, and zone into something so familiar, so safe, it just makes perfect sense. And I imagine that his parents just let him go and sit there whilst watching him and just considering him the miracle of who he is. Because we all know our children are miracles. We know anybody who's given birth to a child, you know, you're transfixed by that moment where your whole life slides and changes and is transformed and is the most incredible thing you'll ever experience. And not that we take our children for granted. We always have that within us, that knowledge. But when you have this moment where you feel that your child could have been taken away from you, it's back in that moment, isn't it? The miracle of who they are, the miracle of their being, and the connection with that miraculous feeling. Look, guys, story doesn't end there, okay? No, just like I said, buckle up. Because we're going on a journey, and it was a journey that had me in tears, literally in tears. If Ben's safe recovery seems like a miracle, what investigators also found in Devlin's small, cluttered, disgusting one-bedroomed apartment would completely blow their minds, as it did mine. Because what I haven't mentioned is that during questioning, Devlin also made another admission. Ben wasn't the only boy he had abducted. When officers discovered Ben sitting on the couch in Devlin's apartment, another young boy was sitting quietly with him. This boy looked to be a few years older than Ben. And when officers asked him who he was, he replied with four simple words that shook a nation to its core. "I am Sean Hornbeck." He was the 11-year-old boy, now 15, who'd been missing from Missouri for over 4 years. And in all honesty, he'd been presumed dead long ago. But he was alive. And he was well. Sean's parents, that's his mother, Pam Akers, and stepfather, Craig Akers, were driving home in a rainstorm when they were told the news they'd been hoping for so long. Their son had finally been found. They broke down in tears at the side of the road, and Craig said, "It is the phone call I will remember for the rest of my life. This is the best day of our lives. It's hard to even come up with the words to express the feeling. It's been like a dream, and we are afraid that we are going to wake up." Pam stated, "I feel like I'm in a dream, only this time it's a good dream, not the nightmare I've had 4.5 years. Franklin County Sheriff's Department, well, they broke the happy news to the media, and we all love a good news story, don't we? They said, "We have some good news for you and probably some unbelievable news. We located Ben this afternoon in the city of Kirkwood, and we also located Sean Hornbeck, who was at the same residence." Investigators had been correct in their suspicions that Sean and Ben's disappearance could be linked. Devlin had actually abducted them both. Now, prior to snatching Sean in 2002, it turns out that Devlin had been patrolling quiet roads for months. So he'd been searching for a young victim for a long time, and he'd spotted this young 11-year-old Sean on the isolated rural road about 0.5 mile from his home. So he'd used his pickup truck, and basically he'd knocked Sean off his bike, got him off his bike, then abducted him at gunpoint. So a really terrifying way to be taken away from your home, simple as that. Now it gets to 2007, and what do we know about paedophiles? Well, a lot of them have got a particular preference of age cohort that they find attractive. So by 2007, Devlin, who preferred younger children, had actually decided that he needed to abduct another Missouri child, again, in broad daylight. This time, however, there'd been a witness. And that witness was, of course, Ben's friend, Mitchell, who had seen this vehicle speeding away and provided a detailed description. It still blows my mind that Mitchell is really the key to this case, isn't it? The fact that his judicious reporting of what he saw literally is the reason why we know that this situation unraveled, because he got those markings on that truck so accurately that people, even neighbours, were starting to question the fact that Devlin could be the perpetrator. Both boys had been kept at Devlin's apartment. That was less than 60 miles from where they'd each been abducted. After the boys were recovered, Sean and Ben were taken to hospital for checkups. They were both found to be very healthy. Surprising that Devlin actually acted so brazenly when you think about this, you know, after abducting Ben, because the detail of the vehicle that the authorities were looking for, it was all over the news. So he must have been seeing the news reports, but nonetheless, there seems to be a superiority and arrogance about him, because he made no attempt to disguise it, no attempt to abandon it. In fact, he even left it parked outside the apartment complex where Bin Ben was being held. And it could very well be that he'd just become too overconfident. You know, he'd successfully abducted Sean 4 years earlier, so he'd get away with it again. I mean, I guess we could argue as well that maybe he didn't want to do something that would seem out of character to his neighbours. So if he had something to hide and they are used to seeing his truck outside, would they then suspect that maybe he was going out of his way to make it look like his van couldn't be seen, in which case that would draw attention from his neighbours? That is another possible explanation, but the likelihood is he's just incredibly superior and arrogant and thinks he can get away with it and outsmart the authorities. Now, the authorities were shocked. When they looked at Devlin's background, it turns out he hadn't been on any police radar. He had no criminal record. In fact, he even used to joke around with police officers who used to visit the pizza parlour where he worked. Very Ed Kemper. Ed Kemper, notable serial killer, also very big guy. He used to do the same. He used to go to like the local bar and chat with the police officers. It's almost like they enjoy the tantalising experience psychologically of knowing what they've done and the police not being aware. Because if you want to be really arrogant and superior, you want to be around people who are trying to do things like bring people to justice, and you know that you are one of those people who should be brought to justice. So again, the mindset of somebody like that is very complex. And like I said, they operate hugely on a sense of superiority. When you look at his work background as well, he'd been employed at the same place since he was 16, rarely missed a day's work. He was highly punctual. One of the things that was noticed, he didn't really talk about his private life. So it wasn't that people didn't want to get to know him, it's that he didn't really allow people to get the information from him. And investigators started to look into his life and considered him a mysterious loner, so to speak. But when they start searching his home computer, well, you won't be surprised to know, loads of child pornography. Loads of it. Unsurprising. He's kidnapped two boys, undoubtedly for sexual purposes. So him having child porn on his computer systems is something we'd expect. And he actually told investigators, "I'm a bad person." You don't say, Devlin. You don't say. Funnily enough, as much as it's nice to have your opinion on who you are, I think your actions show us that we don't really need any further synopsis of your character. You are indeed more than a bad person. You're a kidnapper and a paedophile child molester. How does that fit you? Does that fit you well? I think that fits you well. I think that fits him well. Yeah? It's just me. Nah, it fits him well, doesn't it? Now, what the police also discover is that apparently Devlin did used to be a relatively outgoing individual, but then he developed diabetes and he ends up having two of his toes amputated in 2002, and that limited his mobility. This is the same year that he abducted Sean. So obviously he's got a higher level of stress, but also because he is in a situation where he's living by himself and not getting out, it probably starts to really amplify some of his more dark thoughts and gives him an opportunity to plan and so on and so forth. So it seems that about 2002, aside from the mobility issues, he starts to lose contact with his friends, and people say he became a recluse. So he tends to stay inside and play video games. In fact, it was known that he only left his apartment to go to work.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the chief clinical officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
With a $5 meal deal with new McValue, you pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
I appreciate that a lot of you listening to this right now are going to be both happy and a little bit confused on the level that you're thinking, why did Sean stay? You know, 4 years is a long time. Why didn't he try and escape or get help at some point during the 4+ years he's actually with Devlin? And actually, when you look at the opportunity for him to escape, there were many. He had a multitude of opportunities to do, nearly on a daily basis, if I'm honest. So for the entirety of his captivity, firstly, he was only 50 miles away from his home in Richmond. For the first month following his kidnapping, Sean was apparently kept tied up. Awful. Devlin bound him to a couch and also duct taped his mouth closed. And I'll be honest with you, when the investigators questioned Devlin, well, his initial plan had been to kill him, to literally use him sexually, kill him, and then dispose of the only witness who could call him out for his crimes. This is awful to say. At one point, he actually did try to strangle him, which is just a horrific idea that that child went through this. And whilst he was trying to strangle Sean, it was Sean who managed to stop him. And he said he'd never tell anyone what Devlin had done. And thereafter, it seems a relationship of trust of some sort was gradually established between Sean and his captor abuser. All the while, of course, Sean did believe that if he did try to escape, he'd be killed. And also that his family potentially could be harmed. And think about that. He's got this person who has firstly kidnapped him, secondly imprisoned him, tied him up, sexually abused him, tried to kill him. So Sean isn't wrong that Devlin is somebody who could do him great harm or his family great harm. And this is a child trying to manage all of those feelings. All he's concerned about is other people. What if this man harms my family? So he's a martyr in this situation very much. He's doing what he thinks he needs to do to keep himself and his family safe. The prosecutor in the court actually said this. This boy made this deal with the devil in order to save his own life. This in the throes of it, when this guy had his hand around the little boy's throat. If there is any doubt why this boy lived up to the agreement, it was because the defendant gave him one choice, this or death. So true and so abhorrent to know this child went through it. Sean was consistently and persistently sexually abused by this deviant Devlin. That was through his captivity. It happened many, many, many times. The prosecutors would later allege that he sodomized him on at least a monthly basis for the 4.5 years that he was captive. However, it turns out that Devlin's preference was actually for younger boys. And he later told the FBI investigators that Sean was getting too old. And it's at this point that he started to look for a younger boy to abduct. This is what led to Ben's subsequent kidnapping. Sean was actually in the pickup truck with Devlin when Ben was kidnapped. Can you imagine that? Imagine what Sean would be feeling. He's in that truck with his abductor, knowing that the same fate is about to befall another young person. And also, what would he be holding in his head? What happens when I'm not needed anymore? Because I would imagine that this would be a very unsafe time for Sean. No matter how the relationship with Devlin was, he'd already tried to kill him on one occasion. Was he going to think about disposing of him permanently when he kidnapped this other child? Now, it turns out that as more time passed, Devlin did eventually allow Sean to live a life like that of a kind of average teenager. So he was allowed to go out with his friends unsupervised, given a mobile phone. On one occasion, he actually lost it and it was returned to him by a neighbour. And he actually thanked the neighbour, but he said nothing more. He was even permitted to go on dates, to have girlfriends. Neighbours said when they looked at what was going on, they just thought that Sean was living a really independent life. They even saw Devlin teaching him to drive. Apparently as well, the police came into contact with him on at least 4 occasions when he wasn't with his abductor. He didn't attend school, I have to acknowledge that, because undoubtedly that would have raised far too many questions and it would have led to Devlin's arrest because they just wouldn't have been able to give the detail that the school needed. So despite interacting with people every single day who could actually have helped, Sean didn't tell anybody who he was nor what had happened to him. Neighbours just thought that Devlin and Sean were father and son. One even stated that the two even pitched up a tent in the rear of the apartment block on one occasion. So the neighbours knew them. Now, although Sean did have access to the internet and a phone, he just felt completely unable to contact his parents. However, he was able to send them a message on the website that had been used and set up to try to help find him. And he actually used his real name and he posted the message, "How long will you be looking for your son?" Just think about that. What does that message actually say? It says, "I'm here. Please keep looking." And this imagined perception in his mind that maybe there'll be a point where they'll stop. I mean, no child understands the gravity of love for their child. No child understands it. It's one of the things that I struggle with my own children. They'll say, "I love you all the world." And I'm like, no, I love you or the world. And they'll be like, I'll always love you more than anybody else. And I'm like, no, you won't. One day you'll have your own children. One day you'll have your own partner. And I will take my place and position. You will love me. You will love me deeply. But you will not love me ultimately. I will love you ultimately. It's something, like I said, they can't know now. But essentially, I get it. In Sean's mind, it could be maybe they will forget me. Anyway, he actually said the reason that he did it was he hoped that it would give them some kind of a hint. Now, his father did see that message, and sadly, he actually presumed that it was somebody just playing a sick joke using his son's name. What really upsets me about what's happened to Sean is, aside from this reprehensible abduction, imprisonment, and abuse which he suffered, is that after he was found, many people criticised him. Yeah, people actually felt that it was fit to criticise Sean in the years following his incredible dramatic rescue. They accuse him of being selfish in causing his parents so much pain and anguish because he didn't contact them. They suggested that he didn't want to go home, that he enjoyed his life with Devlin, playing video games, not going to school. Yeah, playing video games, not going to school, being sodomized monthly, being threatened with death, being strangled, all sounds like a great amount of fun. I'm sure most kids think that would be a brilliant adolescence. I cannot express the ignorance of people like this. And I don't know whether people just do it to be objectionable. I don't know whether there are people who just go out of their way to just be as horrible as possible about any situation. I've seen it when people have killed themselves and people get in contact with them on trolls saying that, you know, they deserved it and that they must be terrible parents if the child's killed themselves. You know, there are people that way. Actually, interesting fun fact. A lot of trolls who do really nasty things like that, as much as people are like, oh, they're just faceless bullies, you should ignore them because at the end of the day, they don't really have any power. And at the end of the day, they're probably sad little people who just have nothing to do with their lives. Actually, not true. A lot of research indicates that really high-level trolls, and believe me, I know them, I get them regularly on my feeds, they are individuals who actually encompass the dark triad of personality traits. The dark triad of personality traits means Machiavellian, narcissistic, psychopathic. All three delightful humans, the kind you'd like to invite round for your parties. They're not. Don't do that. It would be a terrible party. Unless it was a party where we could all invite them round just to point at them and laugh at them. Either way, they probably just think that that was because we all like them. You can't really do a lot with a narcissist, can you? Particularly ones who've got Machiavellian intent and psychopathic traits. Who knew? So basically, these people are very nasty. And what they don't understand is the degree of control that Devlin had over Sean. He was 11. He was 11 when he was abducted. Everything that he ever knew was taken away from him in that moment. You know, a captor, any captor, in fact, they can confine a victim, particularly a child, with psychological barriers as well as physical ones. They can put them in a psychological threatening position. They can literally put them in a prison of emotional warfare. They can threaten them. We know in Devlin's case, he backed that up with violence. That paralyzes a child with fear. They feel that their abuser is omnipresent, like a god, like a dark god. You know, what appears to be an obvious chance to escape can seem anything but to a child in that situation. Think about it. Remember, Devlin was a physically imposing man. He was a ruthless predator. At one point, he tried to strangle Sean to death. Sean underwent intense sexual abuse, physical, emotion abuse. Also, he went through isolation early on in his captivity. It's impossible to imagine the magnitude of damage that does. And also, when you think about the fact that he could have got away on many occasions, yeah, he probably also thought that was a test. You know, he'd just been walking home one day and he got abducted. He didn't know whether Devlin was going to be able to come and get him at that point. He probably thought that it was an opportunity for him to experience certain death and destruction if he left. A neighbour actually stated that during the year and a half that he lived above them, he heard all manner of sounds, really disconcerting sounds, including whimpering, pleading, and screaming. And he said on reflection, it was like Sean was trying to get him to stop doing something. Again, I'm going to say it. Guys, if you ever hear something like that in a flat below you or a house next door to you or a garden near you, call the police. call the police. Because if somebody had done that, Sean could have been brought home earlier and Ben would never have got abducted. I know that neighbours don't want to get involved, but you have to at times. Now, as we know, over time, Devlin did give him more freedom. And gradually, of course, Sean began to identify with Devlin. And this is a pattern that's really common to abuse victims. So it's also believed, by the way, that Sean may well have developed Stockholm Syndrome. Now, what is Stockholm Syndrome? And believe me, a lot of people seem to be actually experiencing it right now with some of the things that we've had to deal with in the UK, where people have just been told that they don't need to wear masks anymore or socially distance. Some people are like, I'm going to wear masks and socially distance for the rest of my life. And I have complete empathy with them because they're psychologically traumatized. But to some degree, yes, they've been dealing with coercive control. But also, Stockholm Syndrome is a great description. So what is it? Well, Stockholm Syndrome is defined as an extreme coping or survival mechanism against a hostile situation. The term actually derives from a case in Sweden during a botched bank heist. So the hostages during this botched bank heist developed these really close emotional bonds with the captors to the extent that they're actually hostile with the police who come to rescue them. So they're literally getting saved and they're like, don't save us. We don't want to be saved. We like these guys. But understand this is psychological warfare, and the captors had made them feel that they might be put at risk of death and then didn't kill them, so now they're not bad, right? That's how it works. After the actual event, they supported the criminals. They even raised money for the defence. One of the women later became engaged to one of her captors. Yes, she was probably the same type of person who would have written to Ted Bundy. No disrespect. At the end of the day, we all choose the people that we love, even bank robbers who keep us captive. Now, the victims in this case were only held captive for 6 days and they developed those feelings. Sean was kept captive for over 4 years. So it seems a phenomenon can occur when a victim is psychologically infantilized and the abuser satisfies the infant need for food and love. Over time, the victim can actually develop primordial gratitude towards their abuser. And this is something that seems to have happened in this circumstance. I know that some of you are still thinking, she got engaged to one of her captors? Just to put it out there, yes, Stockholm Syndrome is a strange circumstance, but like I said, ultimately when you're put in a position of threat...
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
In the news this week, the Have I Got News For You podcast is back for another series.
Brought to you by some of the team behind the show, we'll take you through the big stories of the week when the TV show can't.
From Kemi Badenoch to Keir Starmer, Donald Trump to Nigel Farage, we'll make sure to give every story and subject the complete lack of respect it deserves.
We also cover all the sillier stories you've missed that don't make the front page and put your news knowledge to the test with our missing words round.
Listen and subscribe to In the News This Week, the Have I Got News For You podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
And then the people don't go through with a threat and you start seeing their personality, even the terrible aspects, the good aspects will still be noted. And this is how these relationships can become something fundamentally where the captive person survives and survives because they can kind of compartmentalize the devastation that they're experiencing with certain traits of the person who's kidnapped them and try to focus on those good points, which you'd have to do just to make it through the day. Devlin ultimately pleaded guilty to 71 counts. 71 counts. Two counts of kidnapping and 69 counts of forcible sodomy on Sean and sadly Ben as well. He was also later indicted for allegedly taking pornographic pictures and videos of one of the boys and taking the child across state lines with the intent to engage in sexual assault. Awful. He allegedly photographed and videotaped a minor engaged in sexually explicit acts between 2002 and 2007. Although the boy wasn't actually officially named, it's clear to all of us that it was Sean. Devlin later pleaded that he was guilty because he wanted to avoid causing Sean and Ben the pain and ordeal of a trial. Really, Devlin? You wanted to plead guilty to avoid any further emotional distress on said victims. You don't think it's the massive amount of evidence that brings you bang to rights? Literally, they have so much. You have child porn all over your computer. You have a victim in said pictures and videos. You have two victims telling the court that actually you were definitely the person who abducted them, but you're doing it to save their... Can you see how these people do it? Can you see how these perpetrators are so arrogant that even in their moments of capture, they try to pretend that they're not really that bad? I'm not really that bad. I could be really bad. I could put these boys through a trial where they would have to be openly questioned, where the courts would literally see the information that I have taken on photographic evidence and so on and so forth. No, 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 I can't possibly put them through that trial where they would get to show everyone what a heinous monster I was. But I'm going to try to go for the, it's just because I'm a really caring guy. I don't want these kids to go through anymore. I think you did the damage when you abducted them and sexually molested them, Devlin. Just putting it out there in logical terms. You won't be surprised to know that when they gave him the sentence, he didn't get a light one. He got 74 life sentences. That's a total of 2,020 years for those of you who want to work it out. Unless some miraculous everlasting pill gets brought out where everybody's allowed to become eternal, it turns out he will definitely spend the rest of his life in prison, and rightfully so. Round of applause for the system. Also, Devlin has actually had to be kept in protective custody in prison. So he spends most of his time in isolation, separated from the general prison population for his own safety. Won't be surprised to know that, will you? It is notoriously difficult to keep inmates safe who have committed crimes against children. And I'll tell you why. The belief is about 70% of male prisoners have been sexually abused. So you better beware that if you're going to prison, you're not going to prison for child abuse situations, because those prisoners, they have got a lot of baggage that they are carrying, rightfully so. They've been through a lot of trauma and they are just looking for somebody to take out that violence and that feeling that they have experienced and encountered through their own trauma on. So it's not safe. I'm not justifying it. I'm not saying it's okay for anybody to go to prison and get harmed. I am saying that you are dealing with putting perpetrators of horrible molestation against children in situations where those children have become grown-up adults and their lives have been ravaged by that abuse and they have become criminalized and they are carrying that trauma. And those perpetrators that go to prison represent the abusers that took those child's freedoms. So it's really important to understand why these individuals are so angry about abusers. It's because they are looking at individuals who ruin their lives. Prisoners are known to carry out their own type of retribution and justice against these convicts. And in May 2011, Devlin was attacked by another inmate. He was also in protective custody, and Devlin was stabbed over a dozen times. Allegedly, it was like a homemade weapon. It had been fashioned from typewriter keys. Devlin's injuries were described as superficial puncture wounds, but nonetheless, he was badly attacked and it could have gone horribly wrong. It's as simple as that. And we also have to ask ourselves, how is it possible these kind of attacks take place when somebody is meant to be protected by the state to some degree? Because you are, as a prisoner, meant to be protected by the state. I know a lot of you at home right now will be like, no, not these individuals. These individuals should never be protected by the state. But that is why we have to protect them, because terrible things would happen to them otherwise. Now, authorities do fear that Devlin was likely behind some other unsolved missing children cases. And they actually asked the public for information about vehicles that he used to own because he may have been involved in historic abductions. The police task force is now looking into 5 cases of missing children, 5 already. 1 in Illinois, 3 in Missouri, and 1 in Western Michigan. And that's because Devlin had strong ties to that part of the country. One such case is that of 12-year-old Stephen Kraft. He went missing in February 2001. He left his home to walk his 2 pet dogs. The dogs arrived home later. Stephen never did. He literally vanished without a trace. And I think all of us just feel, knowing what he did to Sean when he tried to strangle him, the fact that he planned on killing Sean does definitely suggest that this man could have killed before. Now, a combination of factors led to Sean and Ben's rescue, which soon became known as the Missouri Miracle. There were obvious mistakes made by Devlin. Most notably, it was that he left his distinctive vehicle outside his apartment when its description was all over the news. Not the brightest thing to do. I've just got the getaway vehicle. Just leave it outside my house. I'm sure that no one will notice it, even though it's white, battered, and has got all the markings that have been noted. How did that pesky kid remember all that? I bet that's what he was thinking. How did that pesky Mitchell remember all that information? But nonetheless, he made a big mistake doing that. It's outside his apartment, and it was all over the news. There was also a detailed description, as I've said, of the suspect's vehicle provided by Mitchell. There were extensive media coverage, so it was everywhere. The 2 officers as well who spotted the suspect's vehicle, and also the resident at Devlin's apartment complex who corroborated their concerns. So these all colluded to create this unbelievable rescue. You know what I feel when the universe just steps in and it's like, here you are. I'm going to set up this situation where a miracle occurs because Mitchell exists with his truck savant belief system and knows everything about them. Secondly, I'm going to have an arrest warrant sorted so that these police officers go and notice that truck, and so on and so forth. It feels like something conspired that day to make sure those 2 boys were brought home. Yes, you know what I'm like, guys. I can't help it. I'm a believer in universal potential and the fact that sometimes the universe just steps in. It's as simple as that. Now, following Ben's and Sean's rescue, Mitchell was rewarded. He was rewarded for that vital part he played in their recovery. Bear in mind, this poor kid, when it all kicked off, was like, I'm going to get arrested for either being involved in the disappearance of my friend or driving illegally. I'm not sure which one's going to carry the heaviest sentence, because that's what kids do. But it was his unbelievably compelling evidence that changed everything. So he was rewarded. He received, firstly, a couple of scholarships, and Daimler Chrysler also presented him with a new Dodge Ram pickup truck at the
center. Although, with respect, he wasn't
still legally old enough to drive it at that point either. Aside from this story just being miraculous, aside from this story just demonstrating, you know, the way that human beings can survive these horrible, heinous situations, it also gives us the most important lesson of all. It gives us hope. It helps us to believe that out there right now, in spite of children and young adults and people going missing, that at times, even when the years have passed, it is still possible to bring them home alive. Yes, traumatized. Yes, having had their time stolen. A day away from your home as a captive is stolen. Years, it's just unbelievable to imagine how that's made up for. But it's possible to bring them home. And for those individuals out there with missing kids right now, it is such an important lesson. We cannot give up. We will not give up. We will continue to search. We will continue to keep it in the news. We will believe that one day, ultimately, we will be able to bring those people back to the families that they love. And that is an inspiring, inspiring story to tell. It's so interesting as well to actually look up this case and look at some of the interviews that Sean in particular has done. Incredible, incredible journey. And he's just a powerful and successful young person who has used their experiences for such good. And whilst we all know that those boys will have had terrible scars and trauma, they no doubt have gone on to succeed in their lives. And I think when you look at other cases of kidnapped victims being brought home, it just reminds us we must never give up. And Sean's father actually died a few years ago, the stepfather who I talked about. And that's so important to know, isn't it? because he got to be with his son for those years afterwards. And if he hadn't have been brought home, he never would have. And it's like those stories got a place to go. Those families had a place to heal. And I think for me, whilst I've been on the edge of my seat researching this and telling this story, I think we're all in a place where we just have celebration. It's not often we get to do that, is it, in these cases, where we get to just celebrate. We can leave tonight's case with a sense of peace, hope, and also the knowledge of that unending love that families have for their children. And testament to the police investigators, to the witnesses, to everybody who came together to make sure that this story has a very happy ending, a very, very happy ending indeed. I hope you found it interesting. I hope you've enjoyed this one. I hope you've got smiles on your faces, and I hope you feel very, very hopeful. And our thoughts go out certainly to Sean and Ben and their families, and to all those people who are missing a child. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.